Hello and welcome to
2 o'clock with Kella.
Bring your tea
and leave with more.
Hello.
Hello, welcome. Oh, your screen changed
then. Yeah, I suddenly noticed that. I suddenly went, oh, it went back.
Like, it zoomed out. That was really strange.
Oh, so weird. Okay.
Anyway, welcome back to episode 15 of the podcast. And a very, very exciting episode because this is the first episode in a new little mini series that we have come up with and created, which we're both very excited about. And obviously you'll know the name of this mini series from reading the name of the title of this episode, but it's all about the story of the novel without men, because too much of the canon is men and has been. And even though they're trying to teach us about more women, we even, like, reflecting on our degree, realised that actually the percentage of women stuff that we looked at was so small, and there's so much that we just don't know about going all the way back to the start of the writing tradition and everything. So yeah, we thought we'd do a little series about that, highlighting some of the amazing and maybe forgotten or overlooked female writers of the world.
100%. And it's something of, I feel like people that would listen to this wouldn't be of that not all men mentality.
Yeah.
But it's more so we're doing the story of a novel without men, because, well, the idea came from the best-selling book, The Story of Art Without Men. And I thought that was so interesting, such a good idea, that we were chatting about it and we're like, oh, should we do that for novels? Because that's our thing. And it's just more so, as you said, there have been so few women and their work in the canon or that we study, that it's more so we're just removing the men part so that we can actually study and learn more about these women. I hate when people are like, oh, what about men, like excluding men? So it's not really about that, it's just that we don't really study women's writing that much in comparison, so we want to have a space to do that. And we were talking about, apart from Jane Austen or maybe the Bronte sisters, there's not a ton of women who the general public know, or even in our degree. I feel like we definitely did a lot more books by men. And also the idea is that we're going to focus on the novel, just purely because that would just be too much to do poetry, plays as well. And we love books, and this is a very bookish podcast anyway. So well, let's just go through what's happening. Like, I didn't know before this. I was like, oh, what went on before Jane Austen? I was like, Sappho? And that was it. I mean, there's not really novels anyway until Robinson Crusoe in, like, 1712 or whenever it is. Or novels as we know them. So we just thought, oh, that'll be fun to just pretty much mainly do 18th century to 21st century for the majority of episodes. But we want to do background before that of what was going on before the novel, what was happening with women writers. Because I tell you what, until we Googled it, I didn't know.
Yeah, no, honestly, neither. So this is going to be a nice kind of introductory kind of base episode to give ourselves and you a kind of understanding of female writing and what they were writing about and who the kind of figures were. And then we'll jump on to more novel looking pieces as we know it. So we'll do a bit of Restoration to Enlightenment in a couple of weeks, then 18th century, and then we'll be jumping into doing the Romantic period, Victorian period, modernism and contemporary. And then we'll kind of just keep alternating each week or each episode between those time periods so that we're able to give a kind of nice mix of stuff from the 18th century onwards to the present with female writers. And there's definitely a lot more awareness about contemporary and modernism female writers, but that we've just in our kind of initial research for this, we found so many really exciting and interesting female authors from the 18th century, the 19th century, and even ones in from now and the 20th century that we just didn't know about, who were actually writing some really amazing stuff and doing some really groundbreaking things. So we can't wait to share all that with you.
Yeah, and I hope that you guys listening find it really interesting as well, because first, this is just all about what we're interested in, what we're passionate about. We're passionate about books and novels, and we just love reading and writing. And for me, it's important to actually research this and have conversations about it, because I just think with literature, it reflects a time period, it reflects opinions in the lives and how do you understand each other. Like, that's just the basics of what literature is. And so if we're only studying what's been written by men, then we just miss out on the whole section of life and history. So I think it's so exciting and so important to be studying what have women been saying. I want to hear their voices. I don't just want to hear male voices all the time. So I'm buzzing for this. I'm really excited. This is what I want to know about.
This is so exciting. I feel like we should do our what we've been consuming before we probably dig in, if you want to
Go
keep
on.
with those kind of typical podcast episode sections, do you think?
Yeah, of course.
Hey Kerry, what have you been consuming this week?
So I have been reading a 21st century book by a woman. I think it came out a couple of years ago, I'm not sure. And it's called The Reading List by Sarah Nisha Adams, or it might be Sarah, sorry. And it's a story about a girl called Alicia who works in the library, and one day an elderly man comes in called Mukesh, and he wants book recommendations, and she doesn't read, so she has nothing to tell him. And she's actually quite rude to him. And then she finds a list of, I think there's 8 or 9 books on there, and someone's written on there just in case you need it. And then she reads the first book on the list, which is To Kill a Mockingbird. And then she loves it and learns so much from it. So she tells Mukesh in the end, she gets him to come back to the library and tells him to read this book. And it's so cute. There's different chapters from different perspectives of other characters who have encountered the list, and it's essentially just a list going round of these books that change your life. So it's really, really wholesome. It's the cutest thing ever. And it's just, if you love reading, then this is the perfect book. Like, I mean, if you like reading, then like everyone, I don't even know how to say what I mean, but surely everyone wants to read it because we all love reading. So,
Exactly. No, that sounds so good. I haven't even
yeah,
heard of it.
it's really, really cute. You should read after me. I haven't finished it yet, so it could all go wrong, but I'm optimistic. I'm loving it.
Hey Ella, what have you been consuming this week?
Okay, so I watched Last Night in Soho the other week, and I feel like that's maybe not the best. No, it kind of is a good choice, but also a bad choice of media to talk about in a podcast about women. Just because I mean, it wasn't a great film, and I knew going into it, I knew it wasn't going to be a great film because I remember there being so much hype around it and everyone being quite excited for it, and then everyone being ultimately a little bit disappointed by it. And it is a little bit disappointing. I mean, it's still interesting enough to watch. It's a bit weird. It kind of takes a weird kind of horror thriller. But anyway, the premise is you've got this girl from Cornwall who moves, she gets into fashion school. So she moves to London and enrolls in fashion school. And she's got some kind of quasi kind of psychic abilities or whatever. And she sometimes sees the ghost of her dead mum and things like that, which you kind of at the beginning, you're like, why does that matter? But she doesn't get on with her like, the people who she's living in halls with. She finds an advert for a little bed sit in Fitzrovia, of all places. Who can afford that?
Whoa,
So she's living on this top floor in this, essentially this annex, but in the top floor of this house. And at night she starts having dreams of this woman, played by Anya Taylor-Joy. She starts having dreams about this woman And at some point she is this woman, at other points she's watching this woman. And then things that happen in the dreams start to have a physical effect on her own life. So her life, the student's life, and this woman who's from the 60s in London, their lives seem to be kind of intertwining. And she's an aspiring singer, and she's, and then you've got the girl who's an aspiring fashion. I'm just blabbering on, but essentially that's the premise, which is a great premise-ish. But then it just gets a bit weird. There's lots of like weird ghost figures, and it gets a little bit violent. And then it turns out this, spoilers, turns out this woman is like a murderer, but she like murdered all these guys that were taking advantage of her because they were like, oh, if you do this for me or that for me, then I'll help you progress in your career. So it's almost like it's trying to be like a women fighting back sort of story, but it just doesn't quite work because it villainizes the women in that respect as well. So, and it's written, I'm pretty sure it's written by a man and directed by a man, which also adds a little bit of a sour taste in your mouth. And yeah, don't know. It was interesting enough,
Yeah,
but
okay.
wouldn't rush to watch it or recommend it.
That's good to know. To be fair, the only person that has recommended it to me was a man. The women I know who've seen it didn't like it as much. Make what you will of that.
Yeah, and I'd be interested in hearing what other people who watched it thought.
Yeah, maybe I should actually just watch it now just so that I can discuss it with you.
It's like you can kind of see potentially what point they were trying to make, but then it seems to just get a bit twisted and turn out to be maybe saying
Right.
something they weren't sure they wanted to, or that kind of subconscious kind of male authority and male power. Anyway, that's that. We'll stop rambling and we'll get to the exciting part of this episode.
Yeah, to our novels, or not really novels today.
No, because long prose like that wasn't, well, I mean, there was long prose in the kind of 12th, 13th century, maybe a bit before as well, or a bit before with like the epic poems of the Greeks and everything. But it wasn't prose storytelling novel like in the way that we know it now, which originated in the 17th century, 17th, 18th century,
18th, maybe
would you
early
say?
18th.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's more of a look at women's writing in general up till I hate talking in centuries because it doesn't come naturally to me. Really doesn't. But I
You have
think
to think, yeah.
we've got to do up to Renaissance, maybe like about 15th century, we're gonna end
Yeah,
today. It seems
we'll
logical
probably
to
end
just
like
stop before the Renaissance.
mid 15th century is probably
Yeah,
when we end.
probably. Yeah, around then.
Which mid 1400s.
Yeah. And we've got to have a focus moment on Sappho because, I haven't actually read anything by Sappho before, and yet she's so famous. Like the only, like when you say, "Oh, think of a female writer," you go Sappho. Apart from, like Austen and Bronte's. And we're also going to have a moment talking about Julian of Norwich, who I have never heard of in my life, but is supposed to be, what is she heralded as?
Well, she was a very, very religious woman who was actually a, what do they call it in here? They call her an anchoress.
Which I had to Google. I didn't know that, what that meant.
I'd never heard of the term before, but essentially it's described as a religious recluse. So she was confined to, she vowed to never leave this place and just focus on God and religious teachings and learnings. And that's what she did. And she started to have these visions, and she wrote down these visions. I don't know whether you want to call them prophecies, visions, but she was very well known for all of that. She wrote a lot of long form prose about that.
So technically, she's the first known book in English by a woman would be the book of her visions called Revelations of Divine Love. But it's not really a novel. A lot of what we're going to be talking about is probably more religious writings and hymns. So it is
That
pretty
is.
cool. Like, she is a kind of the first big female writer in English. But yeah. Well, Jill, did I tell you when I was talking to George, our friend George Ballas, who also did English at uni with us, she knew her because she works at publishers in Cambridge, which obviously isn't that far from Norwich, so they're always publishing books about her. But I just haven't heard of her. And
No.
we were talking when we came up with the idea to do this mini series about, I said, well, what was the first novel ever written by a woman? Or who's like the first big female writer? And I actually don't know. So I'm
No,
loving this already, learning so much. So anyway,
I know.
won't divulge loads right now
Yes.
about Sappho or Julian of Norwich because we're going to go into it, but we're going to go chronologically. Yeah, starting roughly 2000 BC or BCE, whatever terms you want to use. Yeah.
Perfect. So we're now going to keep on track, go chronologically. We'll probably put timestamps in the
Yeah.
description so that you can jump around if you want to.
Yeah. I'm so excited, Ella. I literally never. The whole time we did our English degree, I don't think I did anything like pre-John Donne. I never do stuff like Shakespeare's the earliest I go, to be honest. I never
Yeah,
do
because
far
I
back.
was trying to think, because I don't think I've ever opened my Middle Ages copy of my Norton.
No, I don't
I'm
think
not
I did.
convinced I have, because I definitely did some kind of early modern stuff, but it's not
Yeah.
like we ever studied Chaucer. Like, we didn't actually
No.
study Chaucer, did we?
No, I'd never did Beowulf at school either. Yeah, I've not done Chaucer.
No,
I
we didn't
maybe
study any
not.
of the Greek.
No, I never did that. Because did you know that on a different campus for our uni, when they do their introduction to literature course, they all have to do the Bible to start with and work through the Greeks. And yeah, we didn't do that, which is fine. But yeah, I really want to do. I don't know anything pre-Shakespeare. So anyway. Sorry, we'll stay on track, but I'm really excited because I just haven't studied these periods at all. So this
No,
is
and it's
all
so
new to me.
exciting.
Yeah. Anyway, it's starting
No, take it
all
away
the
with
back.
arguably the very first female author that there is record of.
Yes.
From
Yeah.
2000 BC, which is
Ooh,
incredible.
yes. So this is, forgive my pronunciation, we're going to talk about Enedyuanna. And she is the earliest known poet ever recorded of any gender, which is super cool. How have I not heard of her? And as you say, first named author in history.
Like,
So,
that is incredible.
yeah, I get, how do you not know her? Anyway, she was a high priestess of the goddess Inanna and the moon god Nana, and royalty, it seems.
Yes, because
What
she
is this
was
we got?
the daughter of a king, so she was a princess essentially as well.
Yeah, she's
So she
really
was really doing it all.
yeah. And when we were researching, we found out that she didn't, being a high priestess was actually a big power move, and I think it was mainly that her dad anointed her that for political reasons. But no, I don't think they really had that many high priestesses or like women in that
No.
position of power. I still don't exactly understand really what that is, but it just seems like she's that's a high up religious and political position.
Yeah, definitely. And it's definitely like there are records, and we understand that women did have more power and it were in positions of power during that period of time compared to the 19th century.
Yeah, isn't it
Which is
so
absolutely
interesting?
insane. So interesting, because you see similar things when you look at kind of ancient Greece and things, and you look at the ideas of gender and the power dynamics there, and how kind of open and free it seemed compared to the restricted 18th, 19th century. So it's almost like you've had all these amazing women, and then they're kind of shut down by history, and now we're kind of trying to reopen it again.
It's the same thing with sexuality as well. When you're talking about
Yeah,
ancient
definitely.
Greece, and well known that it definitely had a much more open approach to sexuality than the Victorians, for instance.
Yeah.
I just find that fascinating. How did we move away from that?
I
How
don't
have we
know.
done the cycle? That's a whole nother aspect to do. I mean, with men doing a feminist approach
Yeah.
to all of this, to literature. But so I just love that. And
Yeah.
oh, I should say, by time period we're talking, she lived in the Sumerian city-state of Ur, which is spelled UR, over 4,200 years ago. So that would be approximately 2,295 to 2,250 BCE. And that would nowadays be considered Iraq.
Yes.
That's just that is so that's so mad to get my head around how over 4,000 years ago, she was being a boss, like a boss lady.
Literally, and I remember I read something about the land that her father as king had control over, which was essentially a massive part of that kind of Middle Eastern area, by the Mediterranean Sea and everything, like just the vast amount of land that was owned by them was insane. And I find it really interesting that so much of this stuff, and you can trace back language and even things like maths and whatever to this same kind of area, and it almost feels like an epicenter of humanity in a weird way. Like the
Yeah.
amount of things that have come from there that are adopted and taken in by the Western world as we see it today, which actually they didn't come up with. It was all pre-made by these other people. I don't know. I just find it fascinating. And it's just one of those things that I'm like, why did more people not realize that? I don't know. I don't know if any of that actually made any sense.
No, it did. And I was thinking along the same lines, and it just baffles me that this many thousands of years ago, that people were creating such incredible things. I know that it might seem was silly and obvious to say, but it's just the art from this many thousands of years ago. I've looked at a lot of rock art, and it's just incredible what they're creating when you think what resources they had in comparison to what we have now. And it's also, I find it really fascinating to look at the speed or the pace of the change,
Yeah.
because when we're talking about the literature from this time, it's very religious, and pretty much a lot of what we're going to talk about, it is all religious up until like even like a lot of the writing is all hymns, and like how for thousands of years it seems like that was that again, it might be a gross overstatement, but that seems like that was principally what a lot of the writing was about. And I love
Yeah.
like what happened to then turn novels in maybe like 18th century and all these adventure stories into such a big form. I guess again, like it is a gross over like generalization because like there were adventure stories, there were epics from the Greeks, but it's really intriguing. Like how I just feel like the pace has just picked up since then, and because when you look at movements, like literary movements.
Yeah.
It's pretty much ancient Middle Ages, and then it's like right romanticism, like Gothic, Victorian,
Yeah.
like modernism, postmodernism, like all these different movements is
Within a
crazy.
span of
It's
about
in
200
such,
years.
yeah, in such fast succession.
Yeah, going back to our author, bring it back. I think as well as her writing a lot of religious stuff, I think from what I read, she did a lot of biographical writings as well, which has kind of given historians and people looking into her good insights into what life was like for them. And even there's evidence of kind of schools and teachings, because I think some of the things that she'd written, they'd found lots of different copies of them on clay tablets and things that had been kind of inscribed by what they assume would have been schools. And education settings, essentially, as we see them today. And that's one of the reasons why there are so many remains, and we're able to trace it back in the way that we can because of that. So that shows you even more so how much of a massive figure she must have been in that time for it to have been deemed important enough for people to be learning to read and write to be able to share this. I find that fascinating.
I love that. I love it so much. Imagine being that archaeologist finding those tablets.
Oh my
It,
gosh, insane.
again, it blows my mind how literature can survive for that long, especially because I imagine and I know from studying rock art and things surrounding that oral history is such or storytelling orally is such a huge thing.
Yeah.
So many years, and when you think of how well I know the writing mediums and materials have changed vastly over the years, but I do think when I think about literature, I think of it being written down on parchment. I think, how on earth is that going to survive? And it always amazes me when you go to a museum and you see anything that's say like missing pages. But yeah, that's so cool that we can still find these clay tablets, and I love. It's interesting to think about how that actually changes what you're writing, because if you're writing on a clay tablet, surely that slows down your thought process, and or how when you're writing, it's you don't just write down everything that comes to you instantly. I don't know, surely you're a bit more
You have to be very, I think you surely
but
must be more intentional with what's
yeah
been written and what you're
yeah
trying to say. So
Interesting.
that's so interesting.
Yeah, and also a massive part of the whole why there are not as many women writers, or maybe not that there weren't as many, but why do we not know about them? It's about actually having access to education and resources, and say having access to ink or to tablets and such, or educated in reading and writing, and that is all just such a thing afforded to the wealthier people. And not to women, so that makes so much sense why maybe there aren't as many female writers, and why it
Definitely.
seems like there were more the further on we go in history, or out of the family it'd be very generally speaking, it's the men who would be educated, not the girls. I mean, for thousands of years, I think this isn't really going to change a lot, but. But there still were these women writing. I mean, most of them were, well, like she was a princess, and then other people on this list were noble women that we're going to be talking about. But
Exactly.
hello.
It is one of those things that, but when we're looking so far back as this, the only evidence we have is that physical evidence, which is actually really hard to find because there probably wasn't much of it.
Yeah.
The resources they used couldn't stand the test of time in the way that some of them do now. They probably weren't really bothered about trying to preserve them because these were probably things that everyone knew of and were in such an abundance at the time. And no one is really thinking, oh, I need to make sure I'm preserving this for future thousands of years or whatever. And the things that were preserved would have been the things that they themselves deemed the most kind of important. And I think when you then look at that kind of very generally with the tradition of writing, you can see that throughout history with what's deemed important at the time. The men's writing is the stuff that is kept in the kind of more like 16th, 17th century. Even then, it's just mad. And like you said, with the oral traditions of storytelling and everything, you can't write that down. There are so many different cultures, even nowadays, that is way more important to them than having it written down because it kind of becomes static when it's written down on a page. Anyway, shall we jump a couple
Well,
thousand years?
I was just going to say quickly before that, just to clarify, Enedjuana's literature includes several personal devotions to the goddess Inanna and a collection of hymns known as the Sumerian Temple Hymns, in case you want to look any of those up. And I do have a little extract, a little excerpt.
Go, give us an
I could
excerpt.
read from the Temple Hymns. And it is, O E Anu, in brackets, house, which is a ziggurat. Oh dear. grown together with heaven and earth, foundation of heaven and earth, great banqueting hall of Eridu, Abzu, shrine erected for its prince, Edulkuk, in brackets, house, which is the holy mound, where pure food is eaten, watered by the prince's pure canal, mountain, pure place, cleansed with the potash plant, Abzu, your tiki drums belong to the divine powers. That's
Ooh.
from the Temple Hymns. And I won't really attempt to analyse that because we don't really have time for it, and I don't
No,
really
and it probably
know
won't be very
what to make of
interesting.
it. But I can imagine more early literature scholars, if they were to listen to this, they'd be like, yeah, there's loads you can say from this. But I feel like in how we like to do our literary analysis, obviously it's grounded in historical context, but I have more fun discussing the words, like the actual language and the
Yeah.
characters. And I feel like it's more difficult because it's just religious writing. I don't mean just, but so
Yeah.
I think it's nice to have it listen to that. And now we can carry on from that and avoid doing any really basic analysis of it.
Amazing. One last final point on
Oh,
her.
sorry, yes.
If you are interested, in the last couple of years, I think it was in late 22 to early 23, there was an exhibition in New York about her and artifacts and the art from that sort of times. And there's a couple of quite interesting articles. There's a good New Yorker one and a good Forbes article, which gives you a nice kind of basis about her writing and how she was understood. And there's even, I think on the Forbes one, they show you some of the artifacts and how they link to her as well. So definitely check those out if you want to learn a little bit more about her. There's a lot of stuff on the internet about her just from our brief research. So it's nice to know that other people are also kind of digging these people out and writing about them. Yeah, hopefully more people will know her name.
Yes.
On to
Perfect.
someone who I think a lot of people who, well, I mean, we've mentioned it before, will know more so. Sappho, Greek female, probably the famous Greek female, I would go as far to say.
And this is kind of ruining your segue, but I have to say, I have researched some other
Oh, yes, no, please give me some other people who bridge the gap.
well, I don't think they necessarily bridged the gap, but it's just I didn't even realize this, that there are supposedly nine great ancient Greek female poets, of which Sappho is obviously the most famous. But just before her, another famous one. Oh, sorry, I should say the great nine female lyric poets of Greece. So that is Sappho, Praxilla. Again, I apologize, the pronunciation of this episode, not my strong suit. Moiro, Anite, Erina, Corina, Gnosis, Myrtis, and Telesia of Argos. Now, she wrote around about 500 BCE. And when we go to Sappho, I think that's more 7th century-ish. Actually, do you know what? No, she's still BC. Is she still
She's
BCE?
still BC. She's about 730 to
Right. But to be
570
fair,
BC.
okay, so we're talking probably not too many years apart. I can't deal with the BC and
I
AD.
think,
I can't.
yeah, I mean, if we thought centuries, talking in centuries was hard, talking in BC versus AD
Yeah, I
is
can't deal
also
with it.
tricky because of how our calendar and the timeline
Yeah.
works.
So this is
But yeah.
Sappho's 7th century BCE. So actually, Telesia of Argos would come like another 100 years later. But anyway, here we are. And she is super cool because she created a new meter, the Telesilia meter, or the glycemic meter. Now, I was trying to research this and understand the different kinds of meters that these Greek poets, including Sappho, were producing. It makes no sense to me. I'm really bad with meter. There's not iambic pentameter or
Yeah.
whatever Tennyson uses, that dial, what is it, like
Oh,
die something, diatonic, yeah,
diatonic.
that thingy, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not, it's, I can't, which is also why we will be doing novels in future, not poetry. So I can't really tell you. I'm sure there are some other great podcast episodes, but I don't really understand what that meter means. But it was revolutionary. It was a whole new form
Yeah.
of poetry. Oh, and also from her poetry, the longest surviving fragment, because I don't think she had any full pieces of
I think there's
poetry
arguably
alive.
one.
No, for Telesia.
Sorry,
Yeah, sorry.
yes.
Yeah,
My fault, going
the
around.
long spun fragment is about the myth of Alpheus and was possibly a choral poem written for performance at a local festival to educate the girls of noble families. And the little fragment that we have is, "And Artemis girls fleeing from Alpheus." And this just, oh, why we don't, why is that all we have? Like, it's amazing that we have even that, but that is giving me nothing. And I so want to know more about her. It's super cool. She's creating this whole new meter. And I find it really interesting that she's creating poems that are actually intended for girls to listen
Yeah.
to.
So similarly with Sappho, there is only fragments of her writings left, but even within those fragments, you've been able to see that, do they call it the symphonic meter or verse or whatever, which is essentially, I think, in its most base form, it's three long lines and then a fourth shorter line is the kind of base stanza form for this.
So proud of you. All I got out of it was that she wrote in quatrains, and
Yeah.
I was
So,
like,
wrote in
okay,
quatrains, and the
that is
fourth
my limit.
line was significantly shorter than the first three. And I think the first time I encountered Sappho was just kind of as a little side piece in a lecture about rhetoric. I even found this old lecture PowerPoint to see what was said. And it is literally this tiny little side piece at the end when we were talking about rhetoric, because she's seen to be one of the first people who used I in individual subjectivity kind of way, actually meaning I am putting the poet's voice directly into the work, and like her subjective body, and a lot of her fragments are very much about the idea of being and pleasure for women and nature and the links to kind of Aphrodite and things like that. So that's pretty cool, and I guess it's good that she is still mentioned, even if it is just a side point, because of her use of I and the subjectivity there. But yeah, so her longest, sorry, that was a face you were putting, is that a...
No, I would say it's annoying. I know it's annoying, but I feel like she's mostly remembered or known for being a lesbian.
Yeah,
I don't...
which is kind of annoying, because it's like that's not what makes her
Yeah, and I'm like,
so good.
actually, like, that is cool, but I just think she's super. I mean, she her poetry is mainly about love and sexuality, but I just find it so cool that, again, we're seeing so much religious writing, and then she's writing all these more like confessional almost kind of things. I
Yes, definitely.
argue, I love it, like what you're saying with the I and writing all about love and writing about Aphrodite. Like,
Yeah.
you love that from her.
It's definitely a big difference from the kind of tradition of religious writings that came before and still comes after her.
Yeah.
Because it seems like, from looking into it, almost seems like that was the accepted way for women to write and whatever, was through religion and hymns and things. But the fact that she was like, no, I'm writing about like the human experience
Yeah.
in a way, and that kind of personal touch on it that must have been massive back then and still is now. I think it's really, really, really cool.
And
And we do have arguably one entire poem from her, which is only 28 lines, but still that's a hefty poem. Which is called Ode to Aphrodite, which you can find online to read the entire thing.
oh, are you not going to read it all out
You
now?
want me to read the entire thing out? I can read the whole thing. Let me
I
just pull
think
it
you
up.
should.
I've got it here. Okay, so this is Sappho from the 6th century. Ornate throned immortal Aphrodite, wile weaving daughter of Zeus, I entreat you, do not overpower my heart, mistress, with ache and anguish. But come here if ever in the past you heard my voice. From afar an Equestrian came, leaving your father's golden house. With chariot yoked, beautiful swift sparrows, whirling, fast beating wings, brought you above that dark earth, down from heaven through the midair. And soon they arrived, and you, blessed one, with a smile on your immortal face, asked me what was the matter with me this time, and why I was calling this time. And what in my maddened heart I most wish to happen for myself? Whom am I to persuade this time to lead you back to her love? Who wrongs you, Sappho? If she runs away, soon shall she pursue. If she does not accept the gifts, why she shall give them instead. And if she does not love, soon she shall love even against her will. Come to me now again and deliver me from oppressive anxieties. Fulfill all that my heart longs to fulfill. And you yourself will be my fellow fighter. There we go.
Do you know what is fascinating? Mine is completely different.
It?
Yeah.
That's so strange. I mean,
Okay.
I've got the original Greek here on the side, but I don't think I'm going to try
Go
and read that. That's fascinating that yours is completely different.
Yeah. I have such an interest in this. I've told you before about when I tried translating Spanish poetry to English.
Yeah.
And oh my God, it's so hard.
This is one translated in 1982.
Okay, I don't know who translated mine or when it was translated,
This
my
would be
version.
David Campbell's translation from 1982, Harvard University Press.
Okay, but
Interested.
mine is radically different. Like, it's the
Yeah.
same general meaning, but like, this is just fascinating because we talk. In poetry, every word counts, and it's
Every
so
word
about
counts.
the rhythm and about harmonies. It's just how it's all about how things sound, and yeah. So
And
it's
that's why
just
translated poetry is
how,
even harder.
yeah, like doing rhyme. Like how do you translate a poem, especially you translate it from ancient Greek?
Yeah, which is a language that isn't even spoken anymore.
Right.
So, give me some notable examples of the differences. I'd love to know.
Okay, when you said, for instance, release me from these anxieties or something, mine said, release me from distress and pain.
Oh.
Or okay, when you said something about my maddened heart, I had
Yeah.
an emptied heart. And the whole first stanza, I was thinking, wait, have I started in the wrong place? Because my first line is Aphrodite, subtle of soul and deathless, daughter of God, weaver of wiles. I pray thee, neither with care, dread mistress, nor with anguish, slay thou my spirit. And it all feels more Shakespearean in.
It does.
Yeah.
That's so crazy. Like,
Yeah.
it feels, it's one of those things that we're obviously very aware of these differences in translations. But sometimes it is quite mad seeing those such stark differences.
Yeah, it's.
I don't even know what to say.
No. Well, luckily for us, we don't have to analyze it.
No, we don't. We do
Because,
not.
well, no, I was going to say, I just Googled it. I should
Yep.
say, I've said Googled it 3 times. Other search engines are available. I do apologize. But so it turns out that poem is all about a speaker calling on Aphrodite to help in the pursuit of their beloved.
I suppose it's unrequited love at the beginning,
Yes.
I read.
And parts of the work may be intentionally humorous. I love that from her.
Yes,
Go
I read that as well, that it was
on.
like people were like, is this serious or is she just kind of like having a bit of fun with this?
And it's really cool because it alludes to episodes from the Iliad as well, which
And
I haven't read the Iliad, so I
the
cannot.
Iliad was only about, I mean, I haven't read it either, but Homer was about 200 years before. Or 200, 200 years before Sappho, I want to say. Or the other way around. I'm not sure. They weren't alive at the same time. I know that much.
But what I love from Sappho is that the poetry is super emotional. I love it, an unrequited love poem. Super cool. And also, in my research, I found out that quite often it was written to be performed alongside a lyre.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, as in an LYRE, not an LYAR.
Yeah, I can't imagine how you do
Isn't
that.
that really, really cool? I get that is actually quite a historical thing of poetry being performed with music, right? I love that. So I just find her poetry almost sumptuous. Love it. And also super cool that she, this would be more in the fragments, but she was writing about politics and philosophy too. Sappho's doing the most of this.
Sappho really was, definitely.
Yeah, and
So
oh
fascinating.
yeah, this is so cool. Just got a poem. You're like, Aphrodite, help me, I'm in love.
Literally,
Oh
like,
my God, that's literally, I love how relevant that is to now. I'm just manifesting. Please get me on.
honestly, it is. It's just so much of it feels like such a kind of universal human experience. Well, like you said before, literature is about, you can look at the literature to understand what the world was like and how people were viewing it and what was important in the politics, social structure. But at the core of every single thing ever written, you kind of get that core of human experience and what matters to people and what motivates people. And that is the same throughout history, and it's like literature is just everyone trying to figure out those feelings and those thoughts and share that experience because everyone wants to share their woes and their joys and everything. And the idea of that happening thousands and thousands of years ago, and today we're still writing poems and songs about the same things, and still so. I just absolutely love it so much. We're like, oh. What's the point in literature? Is it what's the point in being a human? Would be my answer to that.
Everything is in literature. It's just all about us, not us specifically, but
But
this
people,
is humanity. Well, it's
humanity.
the humanity subject, isn't it?
And I just love it.
Who doesn't love a story? As humans, we love storytelling. We just do.
We do, we always have. We've always found a way of storytelling. And you can see that even through what we spoke about so far. There's always people wanting to share things. That was a bit of a tangent,
I
and
really enjoyed that. Thank you. Do you have any other things to say about Sappho?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, before we go
Yes.
into AD or CE years, I just briefly want to mention a Roman poet or Roman
Ooh,
writer, a
please.
noblewoman. Oh, actually, to be fair, I do think this is in AD,
That's okay
potentially.
because we're moving
Maybe
there
the first,
next
but we're
anyway, so
moving that way anyway. This is in
yeah.
the first, well, I think it's like in the 100s. And well, she was on tour in Egypt as part of Hadrian's imperial court, and she's inscribed three epigrams which have survived about her time there and her travels. And I, oh my God,
That's
woman's travel
incredible.
writing already, which is really fun. And now, anyway, we move on with more discussion going from the year zero to, well, I think we'll do a little segment going up till when it hits 1000
Yeah,
AD.
go for it.
So zero to
Wait.
999. Now, I found, well, you can jump in whenever, but An interesting person that I have discovered in my research is the Aveyar, who's 3rd century Tamil poet, and legend states that she was a court poet of the rulers of the Tamil country, and she travelled from village to village, and she would write songs for all the farmers who were quite poor, and they were mostly songs about a small chief, a low-key chief, and his
Yeah.
family, or about governance. That's all I have to say about her. But again, interesting, this woman traveling around doing political songs. I wouldn't expect that from a woman of this time. Maybe it shows how little I know.
Yeah. It's one of those interesting things because it's hard to gauge whether that was a totally normal thing or whether she was breaking out from the gender traditions because of all the understanding of gender roles and everything we have from the 14th century onwards, maybe like 12th century onwards, potentially. So it's really hard to know because, like we were saying before when we mentioned the ancient Greeks and their views on gender, and even further back, you can't pinpoint the point where it almost started to get more restrictive to the kind of 18th century. So it's hard to know, but it's so fascinating that to think that there were women doing these things, like she was traveling around writing these songs for these people to educate them, essentially, wasn't she? Which is incredible.
Difficult to not impose our modern views on these texts, and
So fascinating.
it's difficult to tell. We don't have time to do deep dive into all these eras of history and cultures as much as we want to, so who knows? But that was unexpected for me, so I thought that's really cool. I've got some other writers so I could
Go
discuss,
for it.
but also
Fire
you can go
away.
for it.
And
Okay,
get to Julie.
right, so there were quite a few Chinese poets around this time. I won't go into their work because, quite frankly, I haven't read it. But I found from about the 600s up to the 800s, we had Chang Wan Wana, Zhu Tao, Yu Xuanji. And then I found, now I actually don't know what nationality this writer would be. I don't know if it sounds Dutch, Germany. But there's a Hot Hot Sliver von Gandersheim from 930 to 1002, who was a dramatist and poet. So there's already dramatists happening. Okay, I guess in ancient Greece, once again, they were doing plays, but that's cool that she was around. There's also a Japanese poet from around the end of the 900s called Sei Shonagon, who is known for writing the Pillow Book. And I have a final person. Also, I don't know. I didn't put a note to myself what the pillow book is, but that's great. That's cool. But it's just nice to throw some names out there.
Yeah,
It's
no,
actually a
definitely.
proliferation of female writers, most of them poets, to be fair.
Yeah, so good.
But my final person from before you bring up whatever you want to bring up, or before we go into the 11th century, is a noblewoman called Murasaki Shikibu. She was around from about 973 to 1014 AD. Why do I find it so hard to read these dates? She was known for The Tale of Genji, and it's considered by some to be the first novel. We
Oh,
did
that's
not think that
early.
novels were happening for a long while in this podcast, but that's pretty cool. So this is another example, potentially a novel. And also I find the contents of this novel really interesting. So it's overall about the lifestyle of some high people in the court in Japan. And it's written in such a poetic and difficult style that it's actually really difficult to read it unless you're a specialist. Which I feel like a lot of people might say that about a lot of literature, but like it specifically says that here. So just imagine how difficult that is. But again, interesting that it's poetic, but kind of a novel in a way. So it tells the story of a guy called Hiroku Genji, the son of an ancient Japanese emperor. And it's about how his father makes him a commoner. I don't know another word for it. But and he falls in love with different people, and it's just about the society at the time and aristocrats, and yeah, it's kind of like a love story, and it's very famous in Japan, I believe, for my research.
Wow.
I mean, that's really fun to have a novel, kind of, that is by a woman that's about exciting things like romance that was happening before even we get to the 11th century.
Honestly, it's just incredible, because it always feels like we're told, oh, like novels aren't a thing until literally the 16th century. But no, that's so untrue. It's just we're either looking to like got kind of tunnel
I guess it just
vision,
depends on definitions, doesn't it? It's difficult.
and that's the thing. Even if you to what ask so many English scholars, what the first novel was, there would be so many differing answers, because there isn't one solid definition of what it is, and because of all the genres are blurred, all the lines are blurry, you just have to kind of deal with that with literature. But that's awesome.
Yeah, I
That's
will
so
say from now on, well, actually, no. More so in episodes after this, as we go further on in time, it does become a lot more Western in our focus than it is a lot of English and American writers, or British and American writers. Purely because there's just so many writers. It's just
we had to
where
narrow
do you
it
go? But
somehow.
it's interesting that in this doing such a broad scope, looking at all of history and female writing, we did want to try and discover what was happening globally with female artists. But yeah, we are
Definitely.
going to, just for sake of brevity, have to be a
Yes.
bit more focused later on. Anyway,
Yeah,
so
and we definitely will mention other notable authors and works
yeah, we'll
as
try
we
and
go
copy
through
that.
as well, so that
Yeah.
we're not just looking at them in a vacuum, but obviously there's only so many we can
Yeah,
look
it's difficult.
into in such detail, and we have to
Yeah.
thematically
Yeah.
decide on those. So yeah.
But yeah,
So
that's me done from the 900s. So I found the first female writer in German, well, the first named female writer for the German language, who wrote the first German epic. But I think of all writers in Germany, she wrote the first epic. She's called Frau Eva. She has different names, I believe, but that's one that I found. She's got a Wikipedia page. I mean,
Amazing.
Wikipedia doesn't give you answers to everything, but it's a good start.
Gives you that, yeah.
And she wrote biblical teachings in rhyming couplets. How cool
I
is
love
that?
that.
Yeah, this was in the 11th century, I think.
Yeah.
Little like Bible teachings, rhyming.
Way of
Oh my
making
God.
it fun. I love that.
Yeah, well, it's really cool. I think she did write a fair few educational things. I love that. I also found kind of half that the end of the 11th century, start of the 12th century, roughly, a couple of them. Hildegard was a writer, composer, philosopher, mystic, medical writer, and practitioner.
Wow, she was doing both.
Oh, what? How? Oh my, I can't. Why is she doing so much? Isn't that incredible? A woman with that many professions at that time, when I
Yeah.
thought that women weren't in the workplace until like the 1970s. And I also have a note here about Li Qingzhao, who was one of the greatest poets in Chinese history as well. So good to mention. But yes, now on to more properly the 12th century. I've got a
Yep.
couple of people, but I thought, oh no, you have your moment to shine, Ella.
Oh, that's all right. That's all right. Well, I think you've definitely out researched me this episode.
I mean, okay.
So very impressed. Love it. But no, as I was flicking through, I ended up doing a bit more kind of paper research,
Mm.
looking at what books I had. But no, I found this woman called Marie de France. Well, that's what she was only ever noted down as in her writings. I don't know whether you came across her.
No,
Probably.
I didn't.
No,
I
you did.
didn't.
Ah, okay. Biographically, all people really know about her is that her name was Marie and she came from France. And because that's the only way she noted herself down, and there isn't really much other information about her. But essentially, she wrote lots of lays, which are narrative poems. And a lot of them were kind of romance based. They're little, like, kind of short romances written in poetry form, but they're little narratives, so they're almost like mini stories in poetry form.
What? I haven't read that.
And supposedly she was absolutely, like, she was really popular with lots of, it says here, counts, barons, knights. And supposedly she also, lots of the ladies who'd listened to her poems when people would perform them absolutely loved it as well. So she was a really well-known poet, writer, who she herself performed a lot of these lays.
Well,
So much so that she became one of the, like, founding figures, as such, of the Brenton Lay. And supposedly she either knew Henry II or definitely wrote about him in some of them as well. So this is kind of early 12th century. But yeah, I just thought that was really fascinating that even though, and even more so, that there's no one really remembers much about her herself, but the work and the impact that her writing had on history. And she'd also add elements of kind of mystery and magic into them as well. So it's almost that kind of, like, feels like early stages of magical realism type things going on as well. And I feel like these sort of ideas must have filtered into the kind of big chivalrous poems and things that were written. Like, when you think of all, like, the King Arthur sort of realms and things, and Chaucer and whatever, because she was just before Chaucer in the timeline as well. So, but yeah, I just thought that was really interesting.
And that's another thing I'd love as well, is you mentioning that women would listen to her poems as well. I love that woman being able to actually write for women.
I know. And it's just so incredible to think of them being in these, like, big, great halls and having all these kind of barons and knights and nobles and all the noble women and everyone else involved all kind of gathering round and being together and listening to these kind of mystery romances with elements of magic and entertainment. Like, I just absolutely love that.
I love it so much, and I really want to read this. Is there any of her stuff in the anthology?
Yes, there's a couple, there's about three of them, I think, in here, which is very exciting. And it tells you some more details about the kind of form that she wrote in
Okay.
as well. But
Maybe
yeah,
we go to
definitely
the
check
anthology.
this out. And I'm sure if they're in here, you'll definitely be able to find them
Okay.
online.
It's really interesting. See, I love this. We did different research and educating each other even. Well, educating
I know,
us.
exactly. It's so fun.
Yeah.
Very good.
I have a couple more before Julian of
Go
Norwich.
for it.
So another person I found 12th century is, how do you say it? French. It's spelled like Eloise, but it's Heloise. So that just Heloise. Or is it
I
Eloise?
guess so.
Okay.
Say whatever the French accent, you'll be fine.
Yeah, Eloise. And love her because I'm putting bold here, she was significant for the development of feminist representation or female representation.
Ooh, good
And she's so cool. She was essentially writing epistolary novels, like the first form. Well, she wasn't really, it was mainly she was writing letters, but it was a huge, well, she definitely had a huge impact and laid the foundation for those kind of models of writing, which I think letter writing is such a female form of writing, like historically. So it's so cool that her letters actually were beginning, like the foundation of that, and communicating between women as well, like letters, like.
Yeah.
And apparently also the kind of things she's talking about in her letters provide the basis for the building Roman. So I was like, how amazing is that? That this female writer in the 12th century is one, like, created a huge impact and was one of the first writers for two whole genres, like epistolary and building Roman.
That's insane.
Amazing. I love that. Go on. And another person in the 12th century I want to mention is Anna Komnene from Greece. Well, yeah, surely, I think. Because she was the daughter of Emperor Alexios something. And she wrote a significant account of Byzantium. So she's similar to what we're talking about right at the start with. She's doing all of these political military records. I love that it was a woman that is able to contribute, like, because when you see films or and of media, and I know they're made, like, have no relevance to actual history, but I just have this image of women not massively being, like, playing too much of a political role or as such. And it's amazing to see that it was actually the daughter of an emperor that was recording everything that happened, and, like, I just wouldn't expect that. We would love that.
That's
And
amazing.
that's everything I have before Julian of Norwich.
Yeah, I say we just dive right into Julian of Norwich,
Yeah.
who was around in the middle of the 14th century, middle to late 14th, would you say?
Yeah, she was around 1342 to 1416.
And as we briefly mentioned earlier, she was what was known as an anchoress. So she basically devoted her life to the church in quite an extreme way. And she started having these visions. I can't remember exactly
Wasn't it about her
how.
actually interacting with Jesus?
Yeah, she believed that she was interacting with him and saw him kind of at his crucifixion and before. And it's like the whole Joan of Arc story as well. I find things like this so interesting. There's so much about religion that just fascinates me. And things like this as well, and this whole idea of visions, and I don't know where I'm going with this.
Okay, well, just to reiterate what we said at the start, so probably the first book to be written in English language by a woman is her book, Revelations of Divine Love.
Yes.
And she was writing during the time of Black Death and the Peasants' Revolt. It's crazy to think about that we have a book from this time by a woman during Black Death time. I don't know if it's just me that blows my mind, but there you go.
No, it is insane.
And the reason for her visions was that she was actually really ill and practically on her deathbed. So then she quickly wrote out everything that she was having visions of meeting with, I think it was the Holy Trinity, or guess Jesus, and then later elaborated and turned it into a longer account. And something that I found interesting in research is that supposedly Julian wrote for a general readership, because I'm just interested with women writing, how did they get to be a writer, and who are they writing for? Like, can they write for other women? But in Norwich, there were quite a few convents that also doubled up as boarding schools for girls, where they would learn to read and write. And so, yeah, I just found that interesting that perhaps maybe she herself had been educated to be able to write it. Although I don't know if you found this, but potentially she didn't actually write it, a scribe wrote it, because she might have been illiterate, because she said something about being a simple creature, unlettered.
Yes, I did read something about that, but supposedly all the kind of accounts of that make it seem like even if she did dictate it rather than writing it herself, supposedly it's very much her and her words and her kind of personality
For sure.
into that as well. And I also read that supposedly she was aware about some of the kind of dangers and the kind of some of the negative views of her being a woman writing, but and kind of sharing her thoughts and her stories, but didn't let that stop her, because she so much believed that the things she was seeing and being told were kind of common property that everyone should have access to, and it should be shared with everyone. So she was spurred on to produce this in the way she did, because she felt it was so important for the world to know these sort of things. So I thought that was really interesting, that even if potentially at this sort of time you're starting to have more restrictions on women and what they can and can't do, she still herself felt like, no, this is important. This is so important that it has to get out there and be shared, and I will write it in whatever way possible. And you see that even with the fact that she was practically dying, like you said, when she first gets these visions. But she was so determined to share that with everyone.
Although it is a shame that it seems as though you couldn't necessarily say that her work had a big impact on other writers or later medieval writers, because I don't know if it was actually the other people in her religious circle, I don't really know how to term it, that they were not quite censoring but not really distributing what she wrote. But yeah, it seems like no one really read it. So can't, well, until maybe I think it was 1670 that it somehow someone published it. I've done my research clearly. But it's what I more so find interesting is it just as an example of a woman's voice, never mind it whether it's had a huge impact on what's followed. Yeah, it was a really interesting female perspective in that I don't really know a lot about religion. I don't know a better way of saying that, but I don't. But this was such a feminist take on it all.
Oh,
And
yeah.
because she's known for writing about the motherhood of God or motherhood of Jesus, and
Yeah.
actually brings into question the gender of God.
Yeah.
Now, well, like, this is a minefield, so I don't have any thoughts
No,
on
but I
that.
also found
But
that really
isn't that
interesting.
just interesting that she's actually talking about religion more in female terms? I mean, a lot, I think overall, the book is just about compassion and why you should trust in God and why you should make sacrifices and why suffering's worth it. It's all about, yeah, love and compassion, the love and compassion that God shows. But within that, yeah, really interesting to have this element of it, of God not necessarily being a man.
Because I think that's one of those, because as well as, like you say, this book has like all the kind of really core elements that you would associate with the form of Christianity that she's talking about and was devoted to. But bringing in that kind of gender question, and it's, to me personally, it feels so feasible that if a deity like God and Jesus did exist, what's to say they have to be bound by human gender?
Yeah, true.
I don't. So it makes so much sense. And then you also think about how, when linking how she describes Jesus as essentially a mother to all and God as a mother as well, and then linking that to kind of ideas of nature and everything, it kind of brings all these elements together. And it's nothing I've ever seen or heard of anywhere else at
No,
all.
I haven't either.
And I wonder whether that is one of the aspects of this, which just seems so kind of interesting and calling to be explored and looked at, that has meant that, yeah, okay, we might have never heard of her before, but maybe that's why when it was published in the 17th century, maybe it did. I don't know what the reception was, but maybe it did get a bit more of a hype, and maybe whoever did find it think it was worth, well, obviously they thought it was
Maybe.
publishing and sharing. And that in itself is so interesting.
Yeah, definitely. I do have I've read bits of it. I mean, I wasn't ever going to sit and read it, or was I?
No.
I just thought might as well read some quotations from it that what you've spoken about. So one thing that she said was, "I understand that the high might of the Trinity is our Father, and the deep wisdom of the Trinity is our Mother, and the great love of the Trinity is our Lord, and all this have we in nature and in the making of our substance." So again, that interesting, bringing into question gender there. It's quite a bit repetitive, actually. Yeah, no, that is pretty much what she says throughout the whole thing.
The
I mean,
mother's
it's
service is the nearest, readiest, and surest, nearest for its most of kind readiness, for it is most of love and most of truth. And in that point, she's talking about this is one of the chapters where she is basically being like, Jesus is a mother figure. Because he's doing this, he's doing that.
I'd say it's not the most riveting read.
But then she talks about like there's some bits where she's talking about kind of the crucifix and the kind of the graphic pain as well. It's interesting that the two kind of go hand in hand. Very interesting.
I think overall, it's a historical document, fascinating. As, oh, I'm going to read that book before bedtime.
I mean, whatever floats your boat.
Do you have any more thoughts on Julian of Norwich?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. I have just a little extra something something after Julian of Norwich. I don't know if that's where you stopped.
Yeah, I have one further person.
Oh, do you know what? Oh, is it Marjorie?
It is Marjorie.
Okay, can I just say a couple and then we can
Tell
end
me.
on Marjorie?
Yes, do please.
Okay, so this is all from still roughly the same time as Julian, still 14th century, but doing a bit of 15th century as well now. We're ending it in the 15th century. Can't be going deep anything further right now. But I found Christine de Pizan, who's a late medieval French writer. How do you say someone who uses rhetoric? Rhetorician?
A rhetorician, yeah.
Yeah. And critic. She wrote City of Ladies in 1405. Now, I think this is super interesting and gives Her Land vibes, right? It's a text about an allegorical city in which independent women live free from the slander of men, as if that was written in 1405.
That's literally a matriarch. Wow.
Yeah, the whole matriarchal society book.
Okay, definitely.
Give it to me where I actually know, I don't know. It is difficult reading texts in medieval language. Anyway, and another person I thought I would mention is Leonor Lopez de Cordoba, who was around from 1362 to 1430 and wrote Memorias, the first autobiography to be written in Castilian or Spanish. And she was banished from the court when she was an advisor to Queen Catalina of Castile, who was the wife of King Henry III. And I think Memorias is pretty much about her time in the court. So again, not novel, but fascinating yet to have written the first autobiography in Spanish.
Yeah, that's incredible.
So that's that. And to end our journey from what was it, 2000 BCE, right up to what are we on now? Mid 15th. Let's end on
Yeah.
Marjorie Kemp. Good old Marjorie.
Good old Marjorie,
Ayala.
who kind of similar to Julian of Norwich in a way, and kind of similar to your Spanish autobiography there, because the Book of Marjorie Kemp is a spiritual autobiography of a medieval laywoman, supposedly called Marjorie Kemp. And it's a slightly odd one because she was also someone who had visions and wrote this story of the visions, but also of her life. But then she refers to herself in the third person. So there's lots of kind of stuff
Yeah, isn't she
happening.
basically right about? I'm a bit confused. I feel like it's the same as Julian of Norwich in that, like, because Marjorie was talking about like fully hanging out with Jesus,
Yeah, like
and
she
she
fully
believed
had
in all
visions that she's
these
hanging out with God.
things. Like, but wasn't Julian of Norwich also talking about like seeing God and seeing Jesus? I don't even know. Well, I
Yeah,
should like, do an episode about it, but I think Mondrian was more explicitly like she had met the disciples. She thought she had.
and I think that's why Marjorie's writing was seen as a bit more kind of controversial and out there, because I think of the way that she was like, no, I saw this. I did this, and I know, and I think Marjorie definitely dictated her story rather than writing it herself, which also has a funny element and talks about herself in third person.
Oh my God, just because I don't know if you're mentioning this earlier with Julian about the crucifixion, and like Marjorie believed she was there. Which, you know, I never knew this about Marjorie. I think, like, I knew of Marjorie Kemp, and I'm pretty sure she came up in the witchcraft module we did at uni.
Probably,
But I did not know that she had actually supposedly encountered all this stuff. Also, this book is thought to be the first autobiography as well, written in English, although it's not really an autobiography. Like, there's a bit of controversy, but people thought, well, it's like, because it didn't happen, how is it an autobiography? So it's more like just
I know,
really
it's sort of, because
writing.
there's part of you that thinks it kind of makes me think of, in a weird way, is it Case 63, where that Spotify podcast
Oh my
story?
God, do you listen to that?
I
Haven't
haven't
spoken
finished the
about
second series yet, though.
it. No,
But
I haven't either. Anyway.
all of those sort of kind of time traveler stories, because like Marjorie, she was so convinced that she'd been there and seen these things, and with the conviction that she was talking about them. And it's one of those things that, if you kind of look at it with an out of the box kind of view, you're like, well, maybe there is a case for time travel in this, or maybe she did, or maybe she was just a little bit insane. And pairing that with the religious aspect of it all, I think, just adds another layer. And not to mention Joan of Arc again, but mention Arc again. I just find it all utterly fascinating. But also, it's all of that aside, the fact that this was a written autobiographical account, one of the first ones in the English language, and it was a woman.
It was. And
It
what a
was.
life she had, even if she if it didn't happen, it's
Even if it
still
didn't happen, like, that's still incredible, because like, what was going on in her brain?
And also because you know she was described as a mystic as well as a pilgrim. Well, I think some other people we've spoken about were mystics, and I googled it. So, well, what actually does that mean? In my mind, that's just someone who's a bit can see into the future or fortune tell, that kind of thing. What it actually means is someone who wants to be one with God, I think. Yeah, I didn't actually realize that.
No,
I'm just
neither.
getting witch vibes.
Because I
But
think potentially in the more modern understanding of mystic,
yeah, like Mystic Meg, you know,
it
or
leans more towards that kind of witchy vibe and everything. Obviously, all this kind of witchy stuff in the next couple hundred years from where we're at now, that is kind of being brought up as well.
And I would say one final thing for me about Marjorie is I love this gal because also I was reading about some scholars interpret her as being more of a persona than an actual like because obviously it's not really her life or it may be what she thinks her life is, but it's more like when we're studying poetry and we're like, oh, that is like that is not Christina Rossetti speaking, that is her, like the
Poetic
speaker of
voice,
the poem, that persona. So yeah, that's when like this Marjorie in the Book of Marjorie Kemp, is that just a character? In which case, it's low-key a bit of a novel, is it? Well, no, maybe
No.
not. No.
Definitely, I totally get where you're coming from there. So it's very, very interesting. I think we should leave it there for
Yes, me
this week.
too. Don't think we're going to do Blonde Moment now, which if you listen to our other episodes, we normally do, because we've been chatting out all these women. And also, this episode's gotten ridiculously long.
It's probably close to an hour and a half, so well done if you've made
Thank
it
you
to the
so
end.
much. I'll try and edit it to be a bit under an hour and a half, but still, thank you so much for listening to all of this. And
We
I hope
hope
you
you
learned
enjoyed.
something and enjoyed it as well.
And we'll be back with a slightly less all over the place. We'll just be looking at two authors, two of their works, or maybe, yeah.
We might
We're going
mention
to
some
look a
other
bit.
people, but
And some other, yeah,
yeah.
obviously we'll always be mentioning other people, but we're going to look a smaller period of time, so it'll be a bit more manageable, kind of restoration to the Enlightenment. That's the kind of vibe. Come back for that. Read a bit of Aphra Behn in preparation if you fancy it. If not, we hope you enjoyed this episode and learned a little bit. I've definitely learned something, quite a few
Yeah,
things actually.
and come back and join us in the 16th century.
Yes. Can't wait. We're little time travelers now.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to 2 o'clock with Keller.
Join us next time for more.